Madiba's Radio, opening up the waves for you to be heard.
Hello and welcome to The Law Show, your go-to podcast for unpacking the legal stories and cultural conversations shaping our campuses and communities. I'm your host, Katlego Mofokeng, also known as Girl with the Nice Pants on the Instagram streets. And today, we're bringing you a very special episode where we journey through two powerful themes, justice and decolonization. First, we unpack the heartbreaking case of Joshlyn Smith, a six-year-old girl whose disappearance shocked South Africa and raised deep legal and ethical questions. Then we pivot to reflect on a powerful campus event about knowledge sharing as a tool for decolonizing our universities. Because here at The Law Show, we understand that the law isn't just in courtrooms. It's in culture, custom, and community too. Now, on February 19th, 2024, six-year-old Joshlyn Smith disappeared from her home in Middelbos, Saldanha Bay. What began as a missing persons case quickly evolved into something far more disturbing. On May 2nd, 2025, Judge Nathan Erasmus of the Western Cape High Court handed down a guilty verdict to Joshlyn's mother, Kelly Smith, her boyfriend, Jacques Napolis, and their friend, Stefano van Rijn. They were convicted of kidnapping and human trafficking. The fourth accused, a Sangoma named Yolanda Cili, was acquitted due to lack of evidence. During that trial, the court heard chilling testimonies, including claims that Joshlyn had been sold for 20,000 rand. One witness said Smith believed her daughter's eyes and skin held spiritual power. Another described how Smith claimed Joshlyn was being shipped to West Africa in a container. Judge Erasmus was clear in his reasoning. The evidence was corroborated, the accused chose not to testify, and their behavior didn't align with innocence. Their sentencing is expected on May 29th, but overall this case is a painful reminder of how vulnerable children are in our society. For students studying law or social justice, it also offers a window into how our legal system handles complex crimes like human trafficking, consent, and spiritual belief. Justice in this case is still in progress, but Joshlyn remains missing. I think we need to be aware of the fact that many children do not get the justice that we think is right for them. We are still waiting on justice for Cwecwe. There are many other underaged children who are facing mass atrocities being committed against them. And we have not seen justice prevail. But this is a great step that our legal system is taking into ensuring that the message is clear. We protect children in this country. We look out for them. And I hope the same can be said for the young adults that attend institutions of higher learning. That we also value those children, the ones that are coming to open their minds up and learn things and widen their horizons and make better lives for their families. I hope we can all take care and protect one another, because that's ultimately what this is about, community. That's what social justice and advocacy work is all about. Now, while the courtroom is one site of justice, campuses are another. Here, justice looks different. It's about recognition, dignity, and the right to belong. Have you ever stepped into this university? The first thing you thought when you stepped into the university and you saw it with all the people, all the students, the lecturers, the classes, did you feel like you belonged? Did you feel like you were a part of this huge student populace? Did you feel one with the university, with its students, with its staff? Did you? That's where we're shifting our focus from the legal system to the lived experiences of students who are redefining what justice means within the university walls. Picture this. It's just after 2 on a quiet afternoon here at Nelson Mandela University when a group of students gathers, not for a lecture or a tutorial, but for something far more intimate. A dialogue, a space carved out for learning, unlearning, and sharing, a space to breathe freely and speak honestly about our identities, our traditions, and what it really means to belong in a university space that doesn't always feel like home. This wasn't just another campus event. It was a necessary pause in the rhythm of academic life, a deliberate act of coming together to talk about knowledge sharing as a path to decolonization. And in that space, I swear to you, something shifted. Members of the Xhosa Society were in attendance, as were students from various cultural communities. But it wasn't about showcasing culture. This was the engagement office's hub, student hubs of convergence, cultural exchange. It wasn't about showcasing culture. It was really about understanding it, living it, and debunking the myths that make our ways of being feel foreign or primitive in academic spaces. The room became a melting pot of diversity, where each student was invited to speak, listen, and reflect. It was a safe space where Ubuntu wasn't just mentioned in a university vision statement, but actually felt in practice. The dialogue moved beyond identity to action. What does it look like to be African at this university? Not just in name, but in practice. What does it look like to build a space where our values, our beliefs, and our knowledge systems are not only accepted, but celebrated? We spoke about disrupting the system, not for the sake of being radical, but because true transformation requires it. Assimilation has failed us. It has made many of us feel like guests at a table we helped build. And so we say, it's time to set our own table, to curate our own spaces, to redefine what excellence looks like when rooted in African values. We need to ask ourselves, do the core values of Nelson Mandela University, those of integrity, respect for diversity, excellence, Ubuntu, do they truly show up in our lives as students, or are they still words on a website? Ubuntu is more than a word we invoke in a time of crisis. Ubuntu is the foundation of how we live, how we learn, how we share. And if the university is truly to become a place of African learning, it must start by listening to the African student. And the question we're asking to you, African student, what does it mean to be African in the university space? Is it an uncomfortable experience where your spiritual values don't align with those of the status quo? Not all of us are Christian, as was mentioned at the cultural exchange. There are those of us who have spiritual beliefs that are rooted in African tradition and customs. And the beautiful thing about that is the ways in which it shows up. Many people were talking about it differently. Others were saying dreams, explaining dreams to, you know, a modern day psychologist would just not suffice. It would spark up a completely different thing that abantu bayothwasa oftentimes are labeled schizophrenics in modern medicine, in Western medicine. But we understand what it is to have a spiritual gift. We understand what it means to see the elders. We understand what it means to see visions of the future. We know what it's like to resonate with large bodies of water on a very deeply spiritual level. But this is not all taught in classrooms. This is not normal conversation you have just in J around the way. Unless you're in spaces where this happens, but oftentimes it really isn't. And so the question was, how then can we bring these spiritual beliefs into this university where we live? Because community is a mirror of who we are. And if we're not seeing who we are mirrored back to us, then that means we are isolated. And so for those who have alternative belief systems and knowledge systems, what does it mean to be an African in spaces where more often than not, the Western practices, traditions, and customs are practiced and normalized so much so that yours are frowned upon? We were speaking about the difference in how when you're well-spoken in English, it's said to be a measure of your intellect. You know, you're an intelligent being who's able to put together these amazing words. You are articulate and eloquent. But when you're able to speak in your native tongue, it's in your mother tongue, it's not the same. It doesn't hold the same influence. It's great. It's awesome to celebrate during Africa Week and on Heritage Day, but every other day, just there's no space for that. So we ask ourselves then, is that truly what we want to see? Are those the reflections of Africanism we want to see, where it's banished to specific times of the month, holidays during the year, and just about that? When and if you know the time calls for Africanism, switch it on. But it's not something you switch on and off. I don't walk in to a place first as black, then as woman, then as every other thing that I am. I was about to expose myself. I'm so glad I didn't. But we don't walk into spaces as these disjointed adjectives. We're all of these things at the same time. So I cannot do away with my spirituality, with my spiritual gift. I can't just put it to the wayside because of the fact that it's not palatable for the Western tongue, because it's not comfortable to be said in regular conversations amongst people who are so used to being comfortable that anything different causes discomfort. And I think that's what it is understanding that diversity comes with some kind of discomfort, and naturally so, because we all have differences in opinions, in values, in knowledge systems. But embracing that, being able to provide safe spaces, curate safe spaces for those voices to be heard, that is so important. And I went to the Value Leadership seminar that they held at the North Campus Conference Center, and there was a bit of a little bit of tension between the old heads and the new heads, you know, the young and the old. And it was a kind of call to action to us more than anything. And you'll hear this more often than not when you go to a seminar, is the fact that there'll be a call to action to the youth. You guys need to make a change. You need to do this, that, and the other. And this young lady who sat next to me raised her hand and said, why is it that we are actually having to clean up your mess as the old heads, as the old generation? And that man said, you know, we could sit here and accuse each other of ruining so many things. But scholars before our time came, they saw the world as it was, said they didn't want the world to be what it is, and changed it. So it's in the actions. Yes, you found an imperfect system, a system that is literally set out against you. Disrupt it. Make sure that you leave a legacy that generations after us don't have to create themselves. One that they'll be so comfortable in that they'll create a new legacy. And the beauty in that is we were a bit stubborn in hearing it. I mean, hearing the fact that, you know, it's up to you now to change the world, when the world really is messed up, is a very, very big call to action. But when you think about it, it's in the intricate small things. It's in gatherings like the cultural exchange. Being able to allow people to practice being who they are in a space like that, offering them a safe space to just talk about what it means to be an African student at this university, whether the core values of the university align with really the lived experiences of students, and sitting there and explaining that and walking through it, you'll realize that some people have similar accounts of what you're going through, and you don't feel as alone anymore. and it helps. The solitude isn't really solitude anymore. It's a collective grief, a mourning, a coming together, and then a change, the catalyst for change. So it really is our duty as the young people now to create these safe spaces with the new adults, as uncomfortable as it is to realize, to walk into, and to just embrace with the new adults. And as the new adults, it's our job to know, not really to know, but to create places and spaces that can better accept us, that are safe for us. These spaces are not readily available, so why not create them? Why not be the change? Be the change that you want to see out in the world. Remember, democracy is for the people, by the people, so that the people speak and the people shall govern. That's what it is. We ended the event not with answers, but with commitments. To share more, to speak more, to remember more, to be unafraid of who we are. And these are uncharted waters, but we wade through them together. Because knowledge sharing is not a side project. It is the cornerstone of decolonization. And through it, we are building a university that not only reflects Africa, but feels like Africa too. What does Africa feel to you? What does it feel like? What does Africa Month mean to you? What does it mean to be African? Or do you just record Thabo Mbeki's speech, "I am an African"? Now, as the dialogue winds down, it becomes clear that decolonization is not just a theory. It's a daily practice. It's in the languages we speak, the customs we honor, and the spaces we claim for ourselves and for each other. From the courtroom to the campus, justice takes many forms. Whether it's accountability in the disappearance of Jocelyn Smith or the reshaping of institutional culture at Nelson Mandela University, young people, students, are at the heart of the movement. We are the voices, the scribes, the witnesses, and the architects of the world we want to live in. So, as we close today's episode, we leave you with this. Ask yourself how you're contributing to the communities around you. How do you show up for justice, for culture, for truth? Do you show up? And if you don't, just ask yourself what your core values are. At the heart of who are you? What drives you? And how can you contribute that driving force to the communities all around you? Thank you for tuning into The Law Show, where we break down the law, amplify student voices, and reimagine justice in our own terms. I'm Katlego Mofokeng. I'm also known as Girl with the Nice Pants on the Instagram streets, and I will catch you next time. Bye.
The best youth station in the Bay. Mativa's Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Madiba's podcast. Here on the Science Package, we're always catching up on all things science, health, tech, and environment. But without further ado, let's jump right into it. The United States has pulled funding for South African medical research, and the first batch of white South Africans have moved to America and were expected to land today. A new drug shows 100% protection against HIV infection, and a study has shown that HIV drugs dramatically lower risk of Alzheimer's disease. Smart rings are the in thing in the tech space. With that being said, it is that time again. The National Arts Festival is here in Eastern Cape. On the 1st of May, the U.S. National Institute of Health, which is the largest public funder of biomedical research globally, published a new policy prohibiting all foreign sub-awards. As a result, billions of rands and research grants for South African clinical studies are unlikely to be renewed over the next year. Sub-awards occur when the principal recipient of a National Institute of Health grant passes some of the money to a second research group with which they are collaborating. This is often with overseas researchers. So, for instance, a university in the U.S. may receive an NIH grant to test an experimental HIV medicine. In turn, they may provide some of the grant money to researchers in South Africa so that the medicine can be trialed in a country where HIV is more prevalent. So under this new NIH policy, that is no longer allowed. So awards that have been directly provided to foreign institutes by the NIH can remain in place, but any NIH-funded projects that rely on foreign subgrants will not be renewed. So South African researchers receive a few billion rand in NIH funding each year, only a minority of which comes from direct awards. So it's thus expected that most of the NIH funding for research groups in the country will effectively be cancelled. It's very unfortunate for us. The new policy doesn't apply retroactively, so researchers aren't receiving termination notices, but it does prevent the renewal of existing programs. So NIH grants are typically provided in annual installments, right? So recipients that were due to have their subgrant renewed on the 1st of May have thus lost their funding effective immediately. So recipients that were due to have their subgrants renewed on the 1st of May have thus lost their funding immediately. So while those that are only due for their next installment later in the year should have a few months of funding left. So as a result of the policy, a number of active NIH-funded clinical trials in South Africa are already grinding to a halt. Some of these trials had been going on for years and were close to providing answers about the efficacy of the new HIV and TB drug regimens. So in many cases, right, the patients were already on experimental treatments. Can you imagine? So the trial staff that were monitoring them will now be axed. So since the new policy is aimed at foreign subgrants, trials across other parts of the world are also likely being affected. So the policy announcement stated that the NIH was developing a new funding mechanism which will ensure that all new grants are provided directly. So the announcement makes it clear that if a project is no longer viable without the foreign sub awards, NIH will work with the recipient to negotiate a bilateral termination of the project. It's conceivable that some foreign subgrants could be reorganized so that they continue as direct awards. But Spotlight and GroundUp has said that in South Africa specifically, clinical trials have little hope of being funded under any new mechanism. Right. So according to an associate professor at UCT, Sean Wesserman, who was running a clinical trial that was sponsored by an NIH sub-award, he explained to Spotlight and also GroundUp that senior NIH officials met with him and his team last week and told them that the award, which was 3 years in, was not being immediately renewed as planned, right? So components of the program that are run outside of South Africa might be funded in the future, the officials told them, but those taking place in the country would not. According to him, they were saying that in this very murky language, that all NIH money to South Africa would stop and that South Africa would not receive funding in the future while other foreign components might. This article was courtesy of GroundUp. Wow. I feel like, you know, ever since whatever news or whatever Donald Trump caught or heard or read, I don't think he read though, I think he probably just heard about South Africa, what is happening in South Africa, he just decided to just come full on bulldozing because he doesn't get the fact that everything that he's doing is affecting everybody in this country. People are going to lose jobs. Guys. But today, like I said, we're talking about a different types of stories, but we've also be talking about, since we always do science and health jokes, we're tapping into tech spaces. We're tapping into tech jokes. So I'm going to give you one joke to think about. You don't have to be an IT specialist to understand IT jokes, which I'm glad, by the way. But What was the spider doing on the computer? I'm going to let you think about that, and then we're going to come back and see what the answer is there. So a clinical trial has shown that drug lenacapavir protected 100% of women and girls against HIV infection. So the drug only needs to be injected twice a year to provide full protection. New results suggest that an annual injection may be sufficient for long-lasting protection. So this new drug, which is lenacapavir, has shown exceptional results in clinical trials for preventing HIV. So in a large study with over 5,000 women and teenage girls in Uganda as well as South Africa, there were no HIV cases among participants who received lenacapavir injections twice a year. So in a second study with 3,265 men and gender diverse individuals, the biannual injections reduced the incident of HIV by 96%. That is a lot for South Africa. So recently, researchers from Gilead Sciences presented results from a smaller phase in a study where 40 healthy volunteers in the US tested a new formulation of the drug. Participants received an injection in their glute muscles instead of under the skin as in previous studies. So 1 year after the injection, participants still had high levels of the drug in their blood plasma, levels that were higher than people who were protected against HIV in last year's studies. So then this suggests that an annual injection can be as effective as the biannual injections. So according to Associate Professor Karina Marquez from the medicine department at the University of California, San Francisco, says that it will be a total change if it does work, which looks promising from the phase data. So longer intervals between doses can make a big difference. It can be difficult for people to remember to take daily pills, which is true when they're healthy and there is a stigma attached to HIV preventative medications. And there's a lot of side effects as well. So I think this will be a great way for people to remember to get the injections, for people to stay safe against HIV rather than pills. Like, because currently we get... there's PEP, which is immediately, right, after, and then there's PrEP, right? So basically, I think for people that don't like to play it safe, it definitely is the best option for us to get injections rather than remembering to take pills every day to prevent HIV infection. So according to Mobali Das, who's the vice president of HIV prevention at Gilead Sciences, he says that people are concerned about people hearing the pills shake in their purse on the bus, right? And seeing them on a medicine cabinet or bedside table is kind of like you would probably like, right? I'm pretty sure everyone does that. Not everyone, but most people, right? Side eye, because you're like, pills, why, you know? So the lenacapavir works by interfering with the virus's ability to replicate, right? Which is also what the PEP pills do. The drug has unusual properties that allow it to remain in the blood for a long time. Researchers have given the drug nicknames like Magical and the Unicorn due to its unique properties. So Gilead has submitted applications for approval of the biannual form of lenacapavir to the FDA and European Medicines Agency and hopes to receive FDA approval by June. So the company has signed licensing agreements with 6 generic drug manufacturers who will sell cheaper versions of the drug in 120 low- and middle-income countries. So in December, Global Fund and other organizations announced plans, right, to secure access to the biannual drug for 2 million people in such countries. According to estimates, 360,000 people died from HIV-related causes during 2023, and an additional 1.3 million people acquired HIV that same year. Yeah, this is according to WAP News. So as I was saying, I'm saying that this will be great for people that forget or for people that shy away from taking pills, that don't want to be known that they're taking preventative measures, or they don't want to have those pills just making noise in their purses, because you take a pill every day to prevent yourself from contracting the virus. So it's definitely, we are all for it. We are all for it and getting the injections. Now, we're going to go back to that joke we spoke about. We said, what was the spider doing on the computer? He was making a website. He was making a website. And what? We're going to give you another one while we go into another topic. So, we're going to give you another one. What is the biggest lie in the universe? What is the biggest lie in the universe? This one is pretty funny because it's definitely, it is definitely one of those lies. So the wearable tech space is transforming with smart rings emerging as a promising new category since the release of Samsung Galaxy Ring, right? So the smart ring arrived in South Africa in April with a price tag of 8,000 Rand, making it the first mainstream launch by a smartphone brand. So it is reported that South Korean smartphone maker had to increase production from 400,000 units to 1 million based on pre-order numbers. So until now, South Africans could get their hands on the lesser-known Next Ring for under 5,000 Rand, which is also is $274, while cheaper options can be found online. So Apple is also rumored to be developing a smart ring. The Galaxy Ring works the way a typical smart ring would. So it tracks health and well-being, like sleep, heart rate, blood, oxygen, skin temperature, stress levels, and select fitness activities. So meanwhile, South African company VezoPay introduced a chargeless smart ring focused on payments, which supports Visa and MasterCards, and is gradually rolling out to more banks beyond Nedbank. So according to the International Data Corporation, the smart ring space is currently dominated by specialists like Aura and Ultra Human, but now larger brands are beginning to compete by incorporating rings into their existing ecosystems of devices, right? Hectic. The research firm believes, not really hectic, I guess just healthy competition, right? The research firm believes the wearables market is evolving with new form factors and innovative products driving growth. So as consumer preferences shifts, because it always does, vendors will need to adapt their new strategies to stay competitive in this dynamic landscape. So according to Jitesh Ubrani, who's a research manager for mobility and consumer device trackers at IDC, says the rate of technological innovation among smartwatches along with consumer interest has certainly slowed in recent quarters, leaving vendors to innovate across price points instead. He went on to say that smart rings and glasses without displays are going to be the most interesting categories in the coming quarters as new entrants and new use cases help these products outshine other wearables. So the widely popular Ray-Ban Meta smart glasses sold 2 million pairs by February 2025, according to its financial year-end results, with plans to increase production to 10 million units by 2026. So according to Horizon Grandview Research, the smart ring market in the Middle East and Africa region is expected to reach a projected revenue of $46 million by 2030. So it adds that payment is the most lucrative application segment, registering the fastest growth during the forecast period. Smart rings are indeed promising and could become indispensable tools for personal health insights and effortless financial interactions. This is according to Forbes Africa. Right, so we're going to go back to that joke that we spoke about, right? So the joke says, what is the biggest lie in the universe, right? That's what I said. So the answer to that is, I have read and agreed to the terms and conditions. You know, when you sign a contract, right? Or you sign online, you have tick or anything like that. Do you really go through your terms and conditions? Do you read them, or do you just go sign? See, most of the time, it might be we might be sharing it as a joke, but most of the time, people are often oblivious to that fact that you just go and sign. You're like, ah, it's a lot. There's a thing that people do these days, fine print, right? And you're like, you don't want to sign. You don't want to go through all of that because you're like, ah, waste of time, right? And you just sign, and then you just out of your way. A lot of people have been caught in other lies, or have agreed to things that they wouldn't have agreed had they known otherwise, right? So as much as we're sharing it as a joke, just keep it in mind, like, or keep it at the back of your mind that such things do happen, that people forget to read the fine print. People just sign and tick and go on about their lives. And then that thing in the long run just comes back to bite them in the So according to Science Alert, scientists have identified a promising new class of treatments for Alzheimer's disease, and they're already widely used to treat HIV and hepatitis B. So along with their antiretroviral effects, drugs called nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors inhibit the activation of inflammasomes, which, as the name suggests, are mechanisms that trigger inflammation. So this inflammasomes blocking was the reason the U.S. research team was looking at the NRTIS. So they analyzed information from two large health insurance databases in the U.S. On 271,000, rather, 198 people aged over 50 with either HIV or hepatitis B. So the individuals in this group with a history of taking NRTIS showed significant and substantial reductions in their risk of developing Alzheimer's compared to those who were receiving different treatments. So in the Veterans Health Administration database, composed of mainly older males, that reduction in risk was 6% for every year of taking NRTIS. The MarketScan database showed that, which team notes includes a broader commercially insured population with a more balanced age and sex distribution. So showed that a risk reduction. So the market scan database, which the team notes, includes a broader commercially insured population with a more balanced age and sex distribution, showed that risk reduction was 13% for every year of NRTIS. So it's not a direct sign of cause of the cause and effect. So it's not a direct sign of cause and effect due to the observational nature of the study, right? But it's a strong association that's well worth investigating further. So according to researchers in a recently published paper, the reduction in risk was observed in two large diverse health insurance databases after correcting for numerous comorbidities known to be associated with Alzheimer's disease. So the inflammasomes act like alarms triggering inflammation in the body and are thought to be involved in a way Alzheimer's takes hold in the brain. So while scientists aren't sure exactly how Alzheimer's gets started, it's clear that neuroinflammation triggered by the buildup of amyloid beta and tau proteins is somehow involved. So and could give us a way into treating the disease, right? So repurposing existing drugs offers one way of developing Alzheimer's treatments more quickly. And the researchers behind this new study now want to see clinical trials of the NRTIS for Alzheimer's, and work is already underway to tackle some of the side effects that come with these drugs, which often include liver problems and impacts on the nervous system. So according to an ophthalmologist in the University of Virginia, he says that they have also developed a new inflammasome-blocking drugs called K9, which is safer and more effective version of the NRTIS. So he says that this drug is already in clinical trials for other diseases, and they plan to also test K9 in Alzheimer's disease. So they're now seeing regular progress in understanding more about Alzheimer's, rather, and developing potential treatments for the disease. So while this latest study only looked at people's specific medical conditions, the findings are mostly notable enough to justify broader research into ways of regulating inflammation in the body. Ambati says that it is estimated that over 10 million people right around the world develop Alzheimer's disease annually. Their results could suggest that this drug could prevent approximately 1 million new cases of Alzheimer's diseases every year. 1 million is quite a big number, especially if 10 million people around the world develop Alzheimer's. So 1 million a year, 1 million a year, you will get to that 10 million. Nobody will suffer from Alzheimer's disease. We'll be able to cure people that suffer from Alzheimer's disease, with whatever, not to prevent HIV. So every year it goes down. Less people die and less people get sick. So the annual National Arts Festival is around the corner, and in preparation for that, Makanda has opened its doors to homestay hosts for the 2025 National Arts Festival. So if people are interested in providing accommodation for event in Makanda in the Eastern Cape, the Sarah Brightman District Department of Sports, Recreation and Arts and Culture, in partnership with Makanda Tourism, is calling on all local residents to apply to host visitors during 2025 National Arts Festival through its official homestay program. So the initiative, which has become a vital part of the festival experience, offers residents an opportunity to earn income while showcasing Makanda's warm hospitality. The program is specially aimed at empowering previously disadvantaged individuals who own homes suitable for short-term accommodation. So to qualify, applicants must own the home they intend to offer to be able to provide a bed and breakfast and have basic hospitality and people skills. So homes should meet minimum standards, including a private bedroom, clean shared living spaces, access to water and electricity, and essential household items such as towels, bedding, and cooking utensils. So furthermore, the house must belong to the applicant, and the applicant must not be a government employee. The applications are open and will close on the 9th of closed rather. The applications have closed, which they closed on the 9th of May. National Arts Festival brings everybody from all walks of life. It brings everybody around the country. You get to see unique designs, beautiful designs. So I definitely want to be part of that. That is courtesy of a Grocott's mail. So before we get on to the rest of our tech jokes, I saw David Attenborough, who is a highly respected naturalist and broadcaster, celebrated his 99th birthday last week and began his career at the BBC in the 1950s, initially as a producer and later becoming a prominent presenter of wildlife documentaries. So he's also known for his engaging style, captivating storytelling, and commitment to showcasing the natural world and its wonders. So he was born in 1926 and developed a passion for natural history as a child, collecting fossils. He studied natural sciences at Cambridge University, who graduated in 1947. So after a brief period in the Royal Navy, he joined the BBC in 1952, starting as a trainee producer. His first major break came in 1954 with the Zoo Quest series, which launched his career as a wildlife presenter. He also served as the controller of BBC Two and later the director of programming for the BBC Television. So you might know some of his documentaries, which are most notably Earned Impact, Attenborough's life series, including Life on Earth, The Living Planet, and subsequent installments. became iconic for their in-depth exploration of life on Earth. So other prominent documentaries that he has done include The Blue Planet and its sequel, The Green Planet. His work has spanned over decades, from black and white broadcasts to high-definition 3D and 4K productions. He has been honored with numerous awards, including the BAFTA Awards in All Resolutions, 3 Emmy Awards for Outstanding Narration, and the United Nations Environment. He has been honored with numerous awards, including BAFTA Awards in All Resolutions, 3 Emmy Awards for Outstanding Narration, and the United Nations Environment Programs Champion of the Earth Awards. So, beyond broadcasting, Attenborough has also played a significant role in conservation efforts and advocating for environmental protection. He has been recognized for his dedication in researching, documenting, and advocating for the protection and restoration of nature. He is a fellow of the Royal Society and has been knighted for his contributions to broadcasting. So, definitely, I would want to get to that age. And he has accomplished so much in the life that he has lived. So he continues to present and narrate natural history documentaries such as Frozen Planet, Prehistoric Planet. His work continues to inspire audiences like me and raise awareness about the natural world and its importance. Happy birthday, said David Attenborough. So finishing off our few tech, jokes, why was the mobile phone wearing glasses? Because it lost its contacts. What shoes do computers love most? Reboots. Why did the computer go to the dentist to get his Bluetooth checked? Autocorrect can go straight to heel. My computer said my password is insecure. Well, maybe it wasn't forced to have such strict requirements. It would be more confident. That's where we leave it for today. Catch us same time, same place here on the Medivas Podcast and the Science Package from me, Pearl. So bye for now.
You're tuned into Medivas Radio, broadcasting live from Nelson Mandela University.
I have fought against white domination. And I have fought against that domination. I have carried the idea of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunity. It is an idea which I hope to live for and to achieve. But if needs be, it is an idea for which I am prepared to die.
Nelson Mandela University. Change the world. Changing the world, one voice at a time.